Hi, I'm Rod Dreher. I'm here on Blogging Heads TV today with Colin Murphy. Before we get to Colin, I just want to say that I am a writer at the Dallas Morning News, the author of Crunchy Cons, and a blogger on BeliefNet.com. Colin, it's a real pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, it's great to join you too, Rod.
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm a big fan of your book. I picked it up this summer before I made a trip of all places to Istanbul. And if you're going to think about the decline of civilization, you know, there's no better place, I think, to go. If you're not going to go to the ruins in Rome, then to Istanbul, which was once, as you know, the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire and is no more. But it's a good place to be because I was reading your book on the plane over there, and I was telling everybody I met at the conference I was at about the book. Because we really are in what I think a lot of people realize is a transitional era. It doesn't mean we're necessarily in decline, but we're changing. Things are changing. And I bet that's why you wrote that book.
Well, that's right. And it's interesting that you bring up the example of Istanbul because, of course, you were no doubt walking through the great, what is now a mosque of Hagia Sophia, and was built as a Christian basilica dedicated on Christmas Day 525 by Justinian. And that was when the dome of that building was constructed. It was the last dome of that size until, I believe, the Duomo of Florence, which shows you what has happened to building skills in the intervening 900 years. So it's an indication of what can happen when a civilization begins to take a downward trajectory. But I was in Are We Rome? I was interested in the age-old comparison, really, of civilizations, and in our case, between ancient Rome and modern America, because a number of parallels really did seem to me to stand out, even though clearly there are vast differences between the two societies.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I went into the Hagia Sophia, which was a mosque, and now it's a state museum after the Republic was declared, they apparently decided it's not going to be any religious building. But you still have Christian and Muslim, not paraphernalia, but signs there, and you still have some of the old mosaics. And I went in through the door that had been reserved for the emperor back in the Byzantine days. And there above the door is a mosaic of Christ with these very stern eyes looking down at you. And you know, you had to stop for a second and realize what those eyes have seen over the years, the coming and going of empire.
Well,
go ahead.
That's right. And but the other thing you see is that society doesn't stop. You know, if you're up on the railings on the second floor and you look at the carvings, that you know, the graffiti that's been left there over the centuries by people coming and going, and you see that there are Viking runes carved in the marble balustrades. So, you know, somehow, you know, commerce will always out, no matter what happens.
Yeah, life doesn't end just because the empire does. You know, I'd like to begin our conversation today, Cullen, with a quote from George Orwell, in which he described a wasp that was sucking jam on my plate, and I cut him in half. He paid no attention, merely went on with his meal, while a tiny stream of jam trickled out of his severed esophagus. Only when he tried to fly away did he grasp the dreadful thing that had happened to him, said Orwell. And that strikes me as a really good metaphor for our civilization right now. There were two events that made me start thinking about Are We Rome and these times of civilizational decline, events that I witnessed myself or had a personal emotional connection to in this decade. The first was September 11th. I was a New Yorker on that day. I worked for the New York Post then. I saw the South Tower fall from the Brooklyn Bridge where I was standing. And I think any of us who lived through that day, whether you lived through it in New York or Washington or anywhere in the country, you felt the deep trauma and the shock of how quickly things can end. The second event was Hurricane Katrina. I live in Dallas, so I didn't have to live through that. But I'm from South Louisiana. My family lived down there, although not in New Orleans. But that whole week, I was just, I felt it so intensely. And I even had to go home from work one day because the city, New Orleans, that I'd been to many times before and loved, suddenly it all seemed to be falling apart. And I think both of those events, which, of course, happened in this decade, reminded a lot of us about how very fragile civilization is and how the things we take for granted, we're really very foolish to do that. Did those events at all inspire your interest in this topic?
Well, not specifically, but the great quotation from Orwell that you've just mentioned really does capture the kind of state of mind that I've sometimes been in. It's the most natural question in the world, just to follow that wasp metaphor. At what stage in the wasp's life are we as a civilization? You know, have we already been cut in half and we just don't know it? We'll know it when we decide to fly away. Are we at some point prior to that? Are we still in the larval stage? And of course, when you have the example of Rome in front of you, you have this enormous span of time from which to pick, you know, possible parallels. You know, okay, does it, you know, if there's a comparison that works between these two places, what is the comparison? Which two points in society are you comparing? Is it Republican Rome versus modern America? Is it the Rome at the height of empire, and so on? And the other thing about the wasp example that really seems like it strikes home to me is the sense of not knowing. In your own lifetime, you actually may not know what the situation is for your particular society. It may be, you know, 200 or 300 years before people can look back and say, oh yeah, we now know that they were on the point of, you know, fill in the blank. And just looking at the example of the fall of Rome itself, this, you know, this epical moment that we assign the date 476 to, how many people in the Roman Empire actually knew that the empire had fallen at that moment?
Right.
If you went to peasants in the fields, if Gallup had existed at that time and had done a survey, probably most people wouldn't have a clue that the empire had fallen, because, you know, in many ways life was unchanged. It only became clearer later on. It's such an interesting problem trying to get that kind of 1,000-year perspective on your own society, which is one of the things that looking at a place like Rome helps you do, I think.
Well, there's that great Auden poem about the youth that falls out of the sky. But the ship has to sail on, and even these great events, the fall of empires, but as you pointed out at the beginning of the conversation, daily life goes on. The people don't disappear just because the empire may.
That's right, and that's one of the issues when I'm thinking about modern America, just the dailiness of life. How durable is the dailiness of life? When just thinking back to to the fall of Rome. There's a wonderful book by Peter Brown called The World of Late Antiquity, in which he talks about the great continuity between the end of Rome and the beginning of what came next, and that in many parts of the world, you know, it's hard to detect a decline. And part of the reason is because certain ordinary things continue. And when I look at modern America and I think about some of the things that worry me most, places where I think we have real problems, at the same time I wonder about just the durable dailiness of life. How much of that will continue? I know that you think about some of these things too, especially this idea of, you know, the continuity of community. I mean, what is your sense, just looking at modern America, about the durability of core institutions?
Thing you're right that really does concern me, and I have more questions than answers, I'm afraid. I've been reading recently Alan Ehrenhold. He wrote a book in the mid-90s. He's the editor of Governing Magazine. He wrote a book called The Lost City about Chicago in the 1950s and how it was a city of neighborhoods, of stable neighborhoods that people could really count on. And it all went away in the 1960s. Well, it went away because, for better or for worse, we had a cultural revolution in the country where people became more interested in individual freedom, individual rights, because they were reacting in many ways to to oppression in the 50s, racial oppression, gender oppression, that sort of thing. But the point Ehrenhold makes in his book is that We want to have the 50s back, that the sort of stable, orderly 50s, the neighborly 50s, but we don't want the bad stuff, the oppression with it. And he says it doesn't work that way. Life doesn't work that way. You can't edit these things out. But the only way you're going to be able to have these sort of stable, safe communities where you have a whole lot of civic trust is if there is an overriding social authority. And we just don't have that anymore. And I was thinking, reading this, about my own life. I come from a small town in rural South Louisiana. Couldn't wait to get out of there. I mean, it was a very safe place to grow up. And I think back at the halcyon time I had as a child out there in the country, safe to play anywhere. But I couldn't wait to get out of there as a teenager. And because we live in the society we do, I was able to, you know, get educated. I was able to go as far around the world as my dreams would take me. And I realized recently that since I left home at 16 for boarding school, the most I've lived in one single address has been 4 years, and I think that's living here in Dallas. And I love that. That's great. I had opportunities my mom and dad never had. But at the same time, I can't let my kids go out my front door and go to the playground around the corner from my house without adult supervision, because all the social trust that was taken for granted by even my parents' generation, all that has evaporated because in large part of the social mobility and the individual freedoms that we have. So I think a lot about wanting to live in a more stable community, but I don't know how we could put it back together absent that social authority that we threw out in the 50s. And in some cases, it was good that it went. I'm not being nostalgic for the 50s. But this is one of the central political problems of our era, and I don't see any easy solution.
There, in a sense, we're talking about two parallel things. One of them has to do with civil society and whether the institutions of civil society are healthy and thick on the ground. And then the other has to do with just the overarching institutions of government. Mostly in my book, I'm not talking about civil society, although it's a very important subject, and you can argue that it's the institutions of civil society that really tied it, you know, European culture over from the fall of Rome to the Middle Ages, and notably the church.
If I could stop you just for a second, it was Edmund Burke who said that we learn to love the little platoons in society. That's where we first, in a democracy, we first get our civic consciousness. And the things you write about in your book about the great institutions of government that people are losing faith in, I think it starts at home.
Well, yeah, certainly. The great institutions that I'm concentrating on in my book, one of them is, of course, the military. And you can argue that in many ways the American military is a very healthy institution. It certainly is racially and ethnically more diverse than many other institutions. And at the same time, that is being compromised in many different ways, both by the strain we're putting it under and also by related to that manpower issues. The other big topic I bring up is just the nature of government itself, the fact that we are allowing functions of government that we've been taking for granted and in many ways rely on to leech out of public hands into private hands. Just looking at the newspaper this morning about Blackwater in Iraq brings both of these topics right into our laps, where you have a contractor that is, you know, there's a question of who even has authority over this company in Iraq when questions arise over its conduct. You know, is it the Iraqi government? Is it the American government? And yet here it is, in some sense, being a tool of American policy. This feeling of you know, the public good, the public welfare, and public objectives no longer really being in public hands is to me a very worrisome one. And you see something very parallel happening in Rome, where, you know, over time, every government job is something that is bought and sold. Every government function becomes something that you pay for. Every person is really out for himself or herself. That sense, that old sense of republican virtue, and, you know, res publica really, you know, means the public thing, virtually disappears, and it's a kind of slow crisis. It's hard to notice how serious it becomes in a single lifetime, but over a couple of centuries, I think it's perhaps the most corrosive thing that is happening to us now.
You know, along those lines, one thing I've noticed about American political life is, when I was researching my book, Crunchy Cons, I went back and read Jimmy Carter's famous malaise speech.
And he never uses the word malaise.
Exactly. But I reread the speech because I was a child during Carter's presidency. I was born in 1967. And I had this memory from childhood of Carter as being this horrible president. And thank God we had Reagan, and he came and he saved the country. And that was my memory as a child. But I read the malaise speech as a conservative, a traditional conservative, 39 years old. And I was amazed at how conservative that speech was. It was all about self-reliance and conservation and limit yourself. And it was a very ascetic speech. And I thought, my God, how is it that we conservatives demonized this man for what he had to say? But in that speech, though, it went over like a lead balloon, as we all know. And I think that it would be very hard for any politician, Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, to make that sort of appeal to the American electorate today, to conserve, to cut back, to sacrifice for the common good. We hear all the time, here on an editorial page, and we're always hearing people complaining about Washington spending all this money. But guess what? How many politicians of either party could come in and say, you know what, we have to do more with less for the greater good? I don't think that person could get elected in the office, and that is a corruption of the people. It's not our politicians. Our politicians give us what we want.
Yeah, I was thinking just the other day, I was trying to look at the five-year period between the beginning of the Iraq War, or the run-up to the Iraq War, and right now, and contrasting that with the five-year period that ends in 1945, when America mobilized for World War II, and just the enormous amount of mobilization and sacrifice that occurred in the 40 to 45 year period, when you think of the amount of harnessing of economic power that occurred during that time, the huge deflection of national will that occurred, the enormous social changes, women in the workforce, the real stirrings once again of civil rights, the industrialization of the West Coast. When you think of all the things that occurred during that five-year period, and now you look at the five-year period that has ended, or that is encompassed by the 5 years of the Iraq War, and you're struck by just the poverty of the modern response. And you know, and part of that is you know, I think a failure of the executive in this case to get us going. But speaking of the executive, one of the things that I bring up in the book has to do with executive power, and as opposed to, you know, legislative or senatorial power in the case of Rome, where over time you see in Rome's case that the sheer volume of the foreign affairs task, the burden of managing empire becomes so great that power almost inevitably becomes more and more concentrated in the hands of one person, or at least arguments are made that it had better be. And to my mind, we see an awful lot of that right now. And I wonder whether there's really any reversing it, whether Congress as an institution actually has already reached the point of no return, and can ever assert its power again.
That is my fear for the next 4 years. I think we will have a Democratic president, and as a Republican, I think that we deserve that. I could not vote for a Republican again after Iraq, at least not right now. Nevertheless, the thing that concerns me about the Democrats, especially Hillary Clinton, is that she and they look at Bush and think that, well, we can do what he did, we'll just be smarter about it. And that the temptation to take the ring of power, to use Tolkien's metaphor, I think it is enormous. And if, God forbid, we should have another 9/11 attack, style attack, I think that we all remember what it was like to be so afraid. I remember it at the time. Bush could have asked for anything, and I know I was so traumatized I would have given it to him. And in fact, I was at National Review in those days, and I remember anything Bush said, I believe, because of the fear. Because I was sitting at my office in the afternoon wondering, okay, the dirty bomb goes off in Times Square. How am I going to get back home to Brooklyn? You know, these crazy thoughts that it would happen every single day. And that's how liberty gets given away. I can see that now in retrospect. Didn't see it then. And I think that if we have another crisis like that in this country, whoever's a president, Republican or Democrat, there will be that great temptation on the part of the people who may not have learned a thing from the past few years.
Let me ask you a question. I don't know the answer, but it's just someone surely has studied this. You know, you were talking about giving away liberty. When you look at Rome, liberty was given away over time. It seems an inexorable process. And nowadays, we certainly are giving up certain amounts of liberty in a trade-off that we think is a fair trade-off for security. At least that's the argument that's being made. I'm just wondering, what are the examples of moments when liberty is given back? I mean, there are cataclysmic moments when liberty is taken again by a people. You know, revolutionary moments, although often those don't work out so well. But are there significant incremental examples of when state of emergency is conclusively ended, and people turn back the clock and say, all of the measures that we put into place we no longer need, and we're going to go back to the status quo ante, and so on. You can almost think of it as kind of a Cincinnatus moment in terms of individual rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There must be, but I can't think of them. Any come to mind?
No, nothing comes to mind. You know, one thing that your question does bring to my mind is how much sovereignty and Republican virtue we Americans today hand over for the sake of comfort and convenience. I'm really interested in how consumerism is eroding Republican virtue in this country. I think right here in North Texas, where I am, immigration is an enormous issue because there's so many migrants, legal and illegal, here in Texas. And we have suburban voters who are very angry about this. They feel like they're losing control of the borders or losing control of the country because all these migrants are here and we can't seem to do anything about it. It is a legitimate concern. On the other hand, I want to say to them, you depend on cheap consumer goods. Cheap consumer goods depends on the labor of these illegal migrants. You know, if you want to get cheap chicken at the grocery store, you get that cheap chicken because the chicken processing plant is hiring migrants that it can pay for, wouldn't have to pay what they have to pay Americans. And so I think that there is something that Americans aren't really aware of, certainly on the political right. We like to talk about price, 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 and the economy, the economy, the economy. But at the same time, we like to complain about all these migrants coming in. As you point out in your book, the barbarian invasion of Rome was not that at all. There was a lot of ebb and flow of population, and the Romans welcomed them in many ways. But after a while, it really did change the culture. And I think I'll close on this. I was at a school recently in a poor part of Dallas, and I was there with some donors. It was a private school. And a young boy, Hispanic boy, was asked to stand up. He was a fourth grader, asked to stand up and say for the visitors who his favorite figure of history is. And the teacher clearly didn't know what he was going to say. He said, "Santa Anna for his great deed at the Alamo." Well, you could hear a gasp in the older Texans there because, he was the great villain of the Alamo.
Sure.
But I thought when I heard that little boy say that, I thought, there is a shift. There is the culture of Texas taking a turn, and in turn, the culture of the United States. And it struck me when I heard that, I was reminded of your book and of the part. I don't mean to say these immigrants are barbarians, but you know what I'm saying, that there is a different tribe moving in and establishing its own values, and it's being welcomed here by economic change.
Well, that's right, but I mean, this isn't the first time. I'm sure Thomas Jefferson would be a little surprised if some other kid said that his hero was Martin Luther King. The country has changed in enormous ways, and in fact, when you really think about it, America is so much more different right now than it was in 1776 than Rome was when it fell from Rome when it began. The amount of sameness in terms of ordinary people's lives in ancient Rome from beginning to end was considerable. In America, there may be certain strands of sameness in terms of mentality, perhaps, in some of our governing institutions. But when you look at the country as the fabric of the country, it's been kind of turned over by a plow every 50 years in enormous ways, by immigration, but not just by immigration, but by economic change, technological transformation, and so on. Maybe that is what our sameness is. Rod, I wanted to get back to a point that you were bringing up just a second ago, though, about Republican ideals.
Mm-hmm.
And it really goes back to also to what you were saying about what happens when a civilization falls or declines. How do you know it's happening? What are the benchmarks? What kinds of things do you lose? And in thinking about what things we would lose first if we went into some sort of real decline as a society. The first thoughts usually run to things like technology and such. But I wonder at this point if actually the first thing we would lose would be self-government, whether that's the most vulnerable cultural trope at this point. I'm not sure, but let's say you suddenly took away a lot of the apparatus of democracy that we currently have, the media, the political parties, and the technology that's holding the country together, and as a kind of experiment, and then just watched what happened afterwards. Do you think kind of American self-government would grow back, or do you think people have kind of let those skills atrophy?
I think they've let the skills atrophy. I was thinking about how, in just the span of one generation, the skills that have been lost in my own life. My father grew up in rural Louisiana. He was college educated, but because he grew up in the Depression, they had to learn how to plant. They had to learn how to hunt. They had to learn how to fix everything themselves, and he did. And most of the men of his generation did, where I'm from. I'm his son. I don't know how to do any of those things. I'm highly trained in what I can do in journalism and writing, things like that. But if we had a crisis, if the avian flu wiped out a third of the population, or there was some sort of terrorist attack that we can't even imagine that plunged us into a civilizational crisis, people like me would be helpless. And more people are moving into the cities.
Do you keep a manual typewriter at home?
No. No, if we lost power, I have a laptop. What am I supposed to do? And I think that Jane Jacobs said that the characteristic of a dark age is forgetfulness. And I think we have forgotten so many of the habits of self-government that you bring up, as well as just everyday things like providing for ourselves in terms of food and heat and fuel, because we haven't had to know these things. And I really am concerned that these things would fall away. I remember when Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita both hit within 3 weeks of each other in South Louisiana. Katrina hit New Orleans, which was in chaos, because I think in many ways civil society had fallen apart there. But then Rita hit the Cajun area over by Lake Charles in the western part of the state. And the Cajun areas, it's more rural, small town, but the Cajuns have a very tight civil society. They still do maintain it. And I was down in Louisiana when that hurricane hit, and it was astonishing to tune into the television stations in Lafayette, Louisiana, and hear the anchormen speaking in Cajun French and in English, asking people to come on out, bring your bass boat out, and go rescue your neighbors. Those were two cases where civil society failed in one case and held together in another. I'm afraid that the New Orleans example is probably the one that's more likely to be the American example. And the first thing that will go, I think you're right, is self-government, because people won't know how to do anything for themselves and will be willing to accept anything that Washington says just for the sake of keeping it together.
Yeah, and will it just be Washington, or will it be the replacements for Washington? You know, this is a question that I have for you, since you are more to the right than I am. And there's a development that I write about in the book. I've alluded to it already, where I could see you going either way, and that has to do with privatization. You know, if we're going to allow, if you don't want big government, and yet there are certain functions that have to be taken care of, so the natural temptation is to invite the private sector in to do them, whether it's your highways or prisons or doing security chores in Iraq or whatever. And I wonder what you think about that. To me, it's corrosive if this goes too far, if this becomes the standard operating procedure. But that's the way it seems to be going at this point, and in many ways it went that way in Rome as well.
Yeah, that's
you must be conflicted on this one.
Yeah, I'm conflicted as well. I'm the sort of conservative who has an equal suspicion of big government and big business. But I think about my own city, for example, and I think Dallas, which I think is probably true for a lot of cities. The middle class has largely left the city. I happen to live inside the city in a gentrified neighborhood, but we wouldn't put our kids in the public schools here because they are just a cesspool of patronage and low test scores and everything you can imagine with an urban school system. The city government doesn't really work that well, and people don't have much faith in it because it doesn't give you reason to have faith in it. And the thing that concerns me, as somebody who worries about civil society, is I don't want to live in a city where the government doesn't work. I think it's important that the government works, but at the same time, it's awfully hard when you pick up the paper every day and read about this corruption, that corruption investigation, and this or that public institution, and you just put your head on the table and like, is this ever going to get any better? I mean, I think that we have. I find it difficult to see a sense of real public service in a lot of public servants. Right now, they seem to be on the gravy train, and I know it's a broad generalization. But I look at private industry, I see corruption. I look at public institutions and see corruption. And you just want to, at some point, just check out.
Well, and I know you have some ideas about where to check out too, or at least you've been thinking about that topic. Let me ask you about that in just 1 second. But as a kind of segue. Someone in one of the reviews of Are We Rome called my stance that of a moderate declinist, which I guess is kind of right. I'm not ready to throw in the towel about our society or about America as an ideal. Far from it. The things that really do have me troubled are things like the enormous pressure we put the military under and the too many tasks that we've thrown its way, and then the topic we've just been talking about, the privatization of government, and then a third topic is just the kind of imperial arrogance we have, even if it's not coupled with a true imperial impulse, but just the notion that we can do anything that we want in the world is very damaging to really doing anything in the world.
Agreed.
And another one is just regarding yourself as the center of everything. But for all that, I mean, these are serious things that can just lead us down the road very slowly, but kind of past the point of return. But for all that, I am basically optimistic, partly because of reasons of the American character, and partly because not all institutions are unhealthy. Now, looking at, if you look at the standard surveys that are published all the time of what Americans think of this or that institution, I mean, it's easy to see that most institutions are held in some sort of ill regard, and many of them are objectively in terrible shape, like the schools and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are not. Some of them are as healthy as they've ever ever been. And some of them, I think, are actually taking new steps to become more relevant than ever before. And I'll give you one example that you may not agree with at all, but I think is actually real, and that is higher education, universities, colleges. By most measures, and certainly compared with a lot of other institutions, they're doing well. You know, economically, more or less stable. They are still regarded as a beacon by almost everyone in America. Everybody wants a college education, at least, and every immigrant family wants their kids to have one. And this is still regarded as a supreme social good. And the people in more and more colleges and universities are, I think, stepping up to the fact that they have to play more of a role in society, but there's a burden to be picked up because others are dropping it. Now, am I being Pollyanna here?
Well, you know, I'm the Cassandra. I'm such a pessimist about things as naturally, but I want to believe you, and I want to resist the sort of natural.
You just have to click your heels, Rod.
I want to resist the natural pessimism I have because. At this point, I have small children. I'm looking at the elementary and secondary schools, and it's pretty dreadful. But you know, I'll grant you that higher education is improving. I have high hopes for my kids to go to college, and I think that if we were a good society, we'd make it easier for more kids to go to college. But when I look at the public schools, that really concerns me because I'm a product of public school myself. And I remember when I was in school, the school still had a certain amount of social authority. I keep coming back to that point. Well, nowadays, I have my sister teaches in public school. I have friends who teach in public school. And they say the hardest thing for them to deal with is the collapse of social authority. And parents, many of them immigrant parents, who are either working too hard or simply have different values about education and authority and discipline. And these teachers are having a hell of a time trying to educate the kids in this sort of environment. And I see people like me. I have my kid. I have one school-age kid. We're either going to homeschool or we have him in private school now. We might homeschool our other kids, not because we want to keep them away from taint, but we just want them to learn. We don't want them to have to put up with the regime of constant testing and, you know, there's no character education, that sort of thing. And I'm not going to make my kid an experiment just for the sake of standing up to public schools. On the other hand, I see where this ends. I see people like me, and middle-class people like me, and upper-middle-class people retreating out of the public square because it's chaotic there and dangerous. And I wonder about where do we leave the immigrant parents and the poor who do want to do better for the kids? Do we leave them in bad public schools? I think that we just go round and round about this topic in our society. We never do come to a resolution, and it does something that really worries me.
Well, here's one institution that doesn't really exist yet, but could become a new public square. You know, when you think about Rome, one of the ironies is that they left the ruins of public squares all over the map, and yet, partly the reason for the decline was just the end of this notion of what the public really is, which is what we're going through too, as you just said. So what about national service as something that we ought to be doing, as a response to some of the kinds of ills we're talking about? When you look back at Rome, there is a phenomenon that occurs that seems to me markedly parallel to what is going on here, and that is the separation of society into mutually unintelligible spheres, and specifically between civilian and military, whereby by the what had at one point been basically a civilian army, everybody obliged to serve. By the time that the empire is in its first century, that's gone. There's a situation that's much more like our own society, where you have an elite caste of people, the chattering classes, the rich, the millionaires club, who really don't have any military obligations at all on the Italian peninsula. Most Romans are not doing military service by the end of the first century. And then you have the creation of a kind of caste drawn from the provinces and then ultimately from the outsiders, who are the military populace. You have two societies there and really not much connection between them, and a lot of suspicion between them. When Diocletian comes to Rome for the first time, he's been emperor for 20 years, but he's never been to Rome. You know, he's appalled by what he sees, the kind of decadent society. Anyway, I don't need to belabor the comparison. It probably feels true to many people. So the concern is, well, how do you bridge something like that? And the idea that's been put forth by lots of people, for years and years by Charlie Moskos, is some sort of national service. So is that a pipe dream, do you think, or is that the kind of effort we ought to be putting our shoulder
on? No, I agree with
which
that.
That's the way it seems to me.
I think we should do something. We have to do something like that to forge some sense of patriotism in the old-fashioned sense, not nationalism, but patriotism as love of country and devotion to its institutions in an honest way. And just this coming weekend, my brother-in-law is going to take off for Kuwait. His National Guard troops battalion is going to be deployed to Iraq. He's a firefighter. He's a working-class guy. It's guys like him who are going to fight this war. So many people I know don't have any connection to this war at all. And I'm not saying that we need a draft to get everybody over there to fight a war, which I think should never have been launched, and we ought to get out of it as soon as we can. Having said that, there is a disconnect between the military caste that's fighting the country's wars and the rest of us who are sending them off to fight these wars. And I think it's very dangerous. And Andrew Bacevich has written, the military historian, has written about the danger of the military being disconnected from the civilians they are supposed to serve, and vice versa.
Yep.
Sorry about that. We had a little technical problem here with my computer. But as I was talking about Andrew Bacevich, the military historian who has warned about the danger of the disconnect between the military and the people it serves. And I don't want to live in a militarized society. I hope that I've learned my lesson, as a lot of Americans hopefully have, about the folly of Iraq, a war I was in favor of, and I hope I've learned my lesson. Nevertheless, we do need something to give a greater sense of we Americans as a country and as a coherent civilization. And I think this is certainly true when you have so many immigrants coming into the country, and we need to find some way to assimilate them, to make them feel like they're part of the country, and make those of us who are already here realize that these are our new citizens too. So I would be all in favor of national service, though I'm sure a lot of people will whine and complain about it, saying that, well, you're putting me 2 years behind on my money-making potential. And I think, sorry, we have to accept that national service is a necessary institution for the good of the greater good of the country.
You know, speaking of assimilation, for a long time that was a kind of dirty word, and it never has been to me. And you can look at the current state of affairs, I guess, in a couple of ways. If you look at elite opinion, you get the notion that multiculturalism is the greatest good and so on, and that we might as well just throw up our hands, that assimilation is a forlorn goal. But I'm not so sure that that's really true among the other 280 million Americans, that assimilation and something that might be called American is still the dream. I just wonder what your view is about that. You know, for all the hand-wringing that you hear on the opinion pages or the letters to the editor, when you get down to brass tacks, are we still an assimilationist society? Are we still this kind of great whirling vortex that sweeps up everything in its path? The way Roman culture really was, it was kind of an irresistible force. People wanted it so much that without ever having to make the, you know, the volitional statement, I want to be Roman, they over time became Roman. And of course, many people did make that statement and avidly, you know, avidly sought citizenship. You know, I think primarily we are still that kind of place, and that we function that way without even thinking about it, and in fact have lost faith in our abilities for no reason. But I suspect you probably disagree.
Well, I think it's a great point. I have complex feelings about it, to be perfectly honest. I was talking to someone a couple of years ago about it, someone who's an expert on immigration, about the difference between the current wave of immigration and the past waves, the great wave of immigration of the Italians and the Irish. And this person said to me, the thing you have to understand is the Catholic Church was the great institution for assimilation. It stood up for the rights of these new immigrants against the broader society, but it also showed them, this is how we do things in America now. You are in America, you've got to adapt. That's gone. Here in North Texas, a few years back, I wrote a column about tension between new Hispanic immigrants and longtime Anglo residents in one of our suburbs. And I called on religious leaders, Catholic and Protestant, to get together and try to solve this through the efforts of civil society. Do you know, Colin, I heard from exactly one clergyman, and he told me, he says, I've been trying to do this in this town for years. Nobody wants to talk to each other. The Spanish want to stay on their side, the Anglos want to stay on their side, and nobody wants to talk about it. So, I don't see any authority in the broader culture to force people to do that. In fact, quite the opposite. We tend to like ghettoization. On the other hand, there is this very powerful commercial culture that seems to erase particularity and to drive people into sort of a homogenous consumerism. And that is, I think, a great engine of assimilation, but at the same time, it is something that I don't like, because I like particularity. I like things to be, people to hold on to what is theirs. And I don't want us all to live in little houses made of ticky-tacky. And so I'm conflicted on it myself. But I do see here in a newspaper, we all tend to be, I'm generalizing here about the newspaper, we tend to miss the people who do believe in assimilation. We get letters all the time from people with Hispanic surnames who say, my ancestors came here the right way, and I'm firmly against this ghettoization. And I want to hear more from people like that and hear why they came to the conclusions that they did and what kind of price they may be having to pay in their own community for sticking to those traditional American beliefs.
It sounds like in some ways, though, we're in the right place from your point of view, in that you're on the one hand fearful of ghettoization, on the other hand fearful of homogenization. Welcome to America, land of no solutions.
Exactly, and I freely confess the contradiction there.
Yeah,
but
I wish that we were able, you know, in modern America, we can look at what's happening in society with great particularity, even though it's hard to draw, great conclusions sometimes about what's going on, much less how it's going to look from the perspective of centuries. We have sociologists, we have journalists, we can go into communities and try to understand what's happening, you know, in this block or this city and so on. And we don't have anything like that for the ancient world, by and large. You know, from time to time, you'll get a trove of inscriptions or, you know, the occasional document and so on that allows you to see things up close in a way that usually you can't. But by and large, we don't have access we can't visualize the processes going on in the ancient world that we know must have been going on. And when it comes to immigration in particular, I think it's a real loss, because, you know, I suspect that the dynamics of outsiders coming in among insiders are fundamentally similar over time. You know, the reactions of individual people to other individuals as they come into your economy, into your family, and so on. And there are tantalizing clues that you get. You look at statuary. You know, from the same place, you'll see a statue of an emperor with his feet on the heads of barbarians, and you know, a raised sword as if to say, you know, I'm the slayer of barbarians. And then you'll see a statue of an emperor welcoming a group of barbarians into the land because, well, they were needed for this reason or that reason, for the economy or for the military. And so, I mean, you know that the kinds of contradictions that are so familiar to us are present in the Roman world as well, but you can't, you know, we just don't have the material to make them flesh and blood the way we can now. And I sometimes, as I was working on this book, just found myself yearning for, you know, to be able to see living people in living communities. Nothing to be done about it, really.
You know, I see we're getting toward the end of our time now. I wanted to ask you one important question about after Rome. You know, one comment that's a quote that's haunted me, and it's probably going to be the basis of the next book I work on, comes from the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who wrote a book, After Virtue, that talks about how community, in his view, and it's the Aristotelian view, community is something that can only be is held together by virtue and by morality, a shared moral sense. And that, in MacIntyre's view, we've shattered that because we have now located the moral authority in each individual. And so we have our discussion of morality is fundamentally incoherent, says MacIntyre, in the contemporary world, because there is no overarching authority that we can all appeal to and recognize. And in fact, we do celebrate, we call it celebrating diversity. But MacIntyre says this makes us weaker as a civil society and as a civilization. And he's quite a pessimist about it. I want to read this quote from his book, After Virtue. This is pretty well known, and this is how he ended the book, talking about late Rome. He said, "A crucial turning point in that earlier history occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium and ceased to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of that imperium. What they set themselves to achieve instead was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. If my account of our moral condition is correct," said MacIntyre, "we ought also to conclude that for some time now, we too have reached that turning point. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are waiting not for a Godot, but for another, doubtless quite different, Saint Benedict." What he's talking about is the Benedictine monks who left St. Benedict of Nursia, left the collapse of Rome, and went out and founded monasteries. And those Benedictine monasteries were the institutions that maintained civilization such as it was throughout the Dark Ages until it could be refounded with Charlemagne and in the Middle Ages. His question is, and this is my question, at what point do we contemporaries decide, Cullen, that, you know what, this is not working anymore. We've got to do something else. That this civilization we're in is passing, and we've got to form institutions to help our communities survive the chaos that is to come. Do you have any sort of insight into that?
Well, I just hope we're able to keep around the IT guy. you know, it's a tough act following Alistair MacIntyre. So I'll keep this brief. And probably slide out from under his question by saying, I'm not sure that we actually need to turn down that road yet. Maybe this is why I'm a moderate declinist rather than a gloomy Jane Jacobs or Chalmers Roberts declinist. The United States has deep resources, both politically and economically, but above all, just in terms of the mentality of ordinary Americans. It is not near to being lost. And one of the great differences between modern America and ancient Rome is just that notion of constant self-improvement and questing on the part of individuals in America. There isn't a parallel to that, really, in ancient Rome, where you had a very self-satisfied and complacent elite who thought that things had gotten about as good as they ever were going to get, and let's just try to keep it this way for the few. That is not really an attitude that you find in America, and so I put a lot of faith in this, you know, what you might think of as America's standard operating procedure. So I'm not ready yet to embrace the rule of Saint Benedict, but I'm glad we've got it on paper, you know, we can take it off the shelf if we need it.
Well, the thing I'm interested in is I'm not myself ready to become a Benedictine, but I'm this close. I think that, you know, what I want to do with my work is go forward and find out where there are communities in this country of lay people, not monastic communities, who are living in some sort of community, but who aren't walling themselves off like Mormon fundamentalists behind these compounds, but who are managing to live lives, productive lives, lives that are open to others, but yet still within a community, and are managing to hold on to their traditions. I'm thinking of people like these Eastern Orthodox Christians I met up in Eagle River, Alaska, earlier this year, who are living around their church, and they're not closed off to the world, but they have a church school there, and they have their church, and they help each other out, and they just want to live in community because the values they hold, they feel like they have to celebrate them in common. I also want to go look at some of the Jewish Orthodox communities I've heard about, not the ultra-Orthodox Hasidim, but modern Orthodox, like in Mercer Island, Washington, who are doing the same thing. I hear that in Oklahoma, eastern Oklahoma, there is a Benedictine monastery going up, a traditional Benedictine monastery. The mother house is in Fontainebleau, France. It's being built right now at Clear Creek, Oklahoma. And I understand that there are Catholic families from all over the country who are buying up rural acreage there because they want to live around the monastery and community. I think these are fascinating experiments. And as you know, American history is littered with failed utopian community experiments. I don't want to live in a utopian community. I'm a conservative. I don't believe in utopia. Nevertheless, I want to see what these folks are doing and see if they do provide any sort of guidance for the future if things do fall apart and the center does not hold ways that we might be able to hold on to the best of the best values of our civilization and continue them until such time as we can reestablish it. But you do give me hope, Colin. I appreciate talking
well,
to you.
Well, I hope you live in enough of a utopia that they'll give you time off to do that book.
Oh, no, that's asking for too much, my friend. Well, listen, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today, and I understand you're going to be at the Texas Book Festival in Austin later this fall. I hope to see you there, and I hope that some of our viewers will come out and see you there because you've written a terrific book, and you're definitely asking the right questions and the questions that more Americans ought to be asking.
Thanks a lot, Rod. It's been great to be with you.